Sims to make sure that everything is in order on your side, and check with AGP to make sure that we're recording.
And we have everyone, so we have our quorum.
Very good. Thank you very much. Then I will go ahead and call to order this special meeting of the Grover Beach City Council on Monday, July 27th at 2020 at 5 p.m. And with this call to order, I'll announce that in compliance with the state and county shelter at home orders, meetings will be held by teleconference only until further notice. This meeting can be viewed on Channel 20 and is available on live streaming on the city's website, as well as slow-span.org. And members of the public may provide public comment during the meeting by calling 805-321-6639, and the phone lines are currently open. So if you would, City Clerk Sims, if you would do a roll call, please.
Councilmember Lance.
Here.
Councilmember Shaw.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Bright. I believe you're muted.
Sorry. Here.
And Mayor Lee.
And I am here as well. So very good. We will go ahead and proceed, as we do have a quorum. And so with that, we'll go into public communications, where just a quick reminder that those who do want to call in, please call in at 805-321-6639 if you'd like to provide any public comment. And so City Clerk Sims, is there anyone who has called in for public comment this evening?
No, there is not.
Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close public communications and bring it to our regular business item, which is the outdoor business operation in private and public spaces. And let's see. The city manager and I have always said we'll just go directly to staff, but I see there's a whole plethora of staff associated with this one. So I will turn it over to the city manager to open, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, council members. Yes, it takes a village sometimes, and this is a staff village, and working together on helping our businesses transition to outdoor spaces. I'll be taking the lead on this presentation this evening. So as City Clerk Sims brings up my presentation slides, I'll just say that your staff team has been working diligently in the last few weeks to help identify an approach that we'd like to bring to you this evening regarding outdoor business operations. I'm speaking on behalf of our team, including our City Attorney Dave Hale, Community Development Director Bruce Buckingham, and Public Works Director Greg Ray. So if you can go to the next slide, Wendy. As we know, over the last few weeks, there has been a significant restriction in indoor business operations. In some cases, the entire operation has been restricted, such as with bars and breweries. But then with restaurants, we have significant restrictions on indoor operations. Pretty much restaurants and dining establishments need to be able to have outdoor seating as well as takeout and delivery. And this also goes for hair salons, barbershops, and nail salons as well. There are limitations on what they can do inside. All these public health requirements, which are necessary to help us contain the spread of COVID-19, have had a financial impact and a financial hardship on our business community. As the council is aware, we've taken a number of steps in the last several weeks and several months to try to address these hardships, from the micro grant program to waiving late fees for utility payments and other actions as well. But there are significant hardships that we're trying to address. Over the last few weeks, staff has been working to develop an approach that we'd like to bring to you this evening that will help businesses and make the transition. Actually, Wendy, just don't go back. If you can please go back, Wendy, thank you. To make the transition to temporary or permanent outdoor spaces, this is brought to you this evening given the timing of this need. This is something that businesses are doing right now, and we'd like to help them in the process and expediting the review and being able to enable them to be successful in this COVID-19 world we're in right now. Our goals are to help promote greater public safety, limiting the spread of COVID-19, and meeting the state public health guidance. So that is the driving factor behind bringing this forward to you tonight. These are temporary applications to meet public health guidance. Now on to the next slide, Wendy. Our approach is centered around four different strategies. The first is the use of parking lots for expansion of commercial uses. I have a couple of pictures here on the slide that show what a couple of our businesses are doing right now with this area. And any picture I do show is certainly not meant to necessarily endorse the business per se, but just to show illustrations of what businesses are doing to try to adapt to this COVID-19 situation. Using parking lots are relatively common. A lot of businesses have access to parking lots, mostly private parking lots, and they have taken steps to help expand into the lot, such as through tables, chairs, umbrellas. In the case of the restaurant on the very top, you see some hay bales to try to delineate between the rest of the parking area and the dining area. The city does require permits for the use of these parking lots. For a private lot, we require a temporary use permit, and for a public lot, if it's publicly owned, we would require an encroachment permit for encroaching into the city's right-of-way. Our plan is for an expedited review, 48-hour review from when we receive a completed application to when we issue a permit, and we are able to do after-the-fact permitting. We have a number of restaurants that have already done this, as the pictures illustrate, and we're planning to work with these restaurants starting tomorrow on these after-the-fact permits to make sure they are adhering to the necessary safety standards and making sure that the accessible spaces in parking lots are maintained at these different lots. So on the next slide, our next strategy is the use of public sidewalks for outdoor dining. Again, a couple of different illustrations here of sidewalk dining is already in place in a couple different restaurants on Grand Avenue. This is particularly beneficial for businesses that may not have access to a parking lot next door to them or a patio space, but have a city sidewalk next to them. We do require an administrative development permit for this particular use on Grand Avenue, as well as an encroachment permit. These are done together, packaged together in one application. And similar to the parking lots, we would have an expedited review and after-the-fact permitting, such as in the case of these two restaurants here. We are already waiving permit fees, which we are doing for the temporary use permits for parking lots. And we also will be making sure that this public sidewalk dining meets the safe and accessible passageway for sidewalks, meaning that somebody can still walk down the sidewalk and be able to move past the tables, which is defined by at least 4 feet of unobstructed right-of-way, and then also making sure that any accessible corner ramps are not blocked or taken away. The third strategy is the use of parklets on select on-street parking spaces. So the first two strategies are steps that are being taken already by businesses, and our job, our role is to help making sure that they're permitted and making sure that we're also encouraging greater use of them. This third strategy is really more prospective and proactive. The idea of parklets is to use on-street parking spaces for seating and dining. It's something that has been in the urban landscape for about 15 years across California and really across the country. They're being used in numerous cities around the state, and they're being looked at now on a temporary basis by more and more cities to help in making this transition to outdoor dining. I'll call to attention the city of San Luis Obispo, which has an open slow program currently in progress and is looking to install up to 20 temporary parklets all around its downtown area to really help its restaurant community in making this transition to outside dining. Other cities around the area are also considering such parklets, including Arroyo Grande, Pismo Beach, and other communities. As of now, there have been no parklets installed in Grover Beach to date, and staff is bringing this forward as an opportunity to experiment, to try something different with this particular way of bringing more outdoor dining. We could look at some temporary parklets, maybe one or two locations, just to get started from a pilot basis. We don't have locations specified this evening for the council, but we would work with the chamber to identify locations based on interest from the business, community feedback and input on where they would like to see potential parklets, but also traffic safety standards. We want to make sure that patrons and diners feel safe and that they're in a spot that is more secure than perhaps an area where there is heavy traffic whizzing by at a very fast rate of speed. As part of a parklet, we need to make sure that we are following the traffic safety standards and having some security and guidance around that. and also making sure that they follow the public health guidance of distance and sanitation, along with liability insurance provided. Based on the experience of other communities, we estimate about a one-time cost of roughly $10,000 in creating a parklet from scratch. That would include flooring, that would include tables and umbrellas and other equipment to help equip a parklet as this temporary seating and dining space. You could do it for less funding if you just have a table in a parking lot, and a picture on the next slide will show just that. So going on to the next slide, I wanted to show the council some illustrations of parklets that are currently in use or being proposed for use right now. So starting off on the top left-hand side, I'll go clockwise from there. Top left-hand side is a schematic from the National Association of City Transportation Officials that really kind of shows what a parklet is about. It's taking a on-street parking space, having an area between the cars and the patrons, usually having flower boxes or planter boxes or railings as a buffer, but really being an extension of the sidewalk, just cutting into the on-street parking space. Moving to the next slide, next picture on the right-hand side is a parklet in San Luis Obispo that's currently in use right now. It's a temporary parklet as part of the Open Slow program, but it shows what this actually looks like locally. The next picture on the top right-hand side is a parklet from the city of Long Beach, which again shows the extension of the sidewalk coming out into the roadway with a series of planter boxes that separate the cars from the patrons. On the lower left-hand side, this shows a different variation. This is from the city of San Mateo that is bringing some tables and chairs into the parking spaces, but it doesn't have the same kind of flooring and other equipment that you see in other parklets, and it has some narrow gates that separate the roadway from the passageway, from the tables. The next picture next to it, where you see some pretty big white rails, is from the city of a town of Los Gatos up in the Bay Area, where they just have some tables in front of the restaurants with these big what are called K-rails, these big white rails that serve as a very significant buffer between a busy street and the tables and chairs. The picture next to that, with the sidewalk and the lights hanging over the sidewalk, is from the city of Long Beach, which shows the same kind of K-rails, they're called, those railing that act as a buffer between the street and the sidewalk, but they're a little more decorative, and you see some other decorations to make that, I think, an even more inviting scene. And then the picture on the far right, I just wanted to call out as a somewhat whimsical example of how you can use public art and other creativity to help make a parklet into a destination, not just a place for tables and chairs, but a place that has some creativity and design associated with it. So that's why they provide some visual examples to the council of what parklets are. You can look online and see countless examples from other communities around the state and around the country. Wendy, next slide, please. The fourth strategy is to work with businesses to allow permanent outdoor space. So the three strategies thus far have really been about temporary spaces to help adapt to this landscape. This last strategy is to help businesses in making a permanent change and creating more outdoor patio space on private property. This is not on public property, but on private property. This may be more limited for businesses. Not every business has private property where it can expand into, but for those who can, this could be an opportunity to make a permanent transition to more outdoor dining. We're working with one restaurant right now on an application to do just that. The pictures on screen here are not from Grover Beach. These are some examples of what more permanent outdoor patio space could look like. It's really involving more hardscape and more permanent features. This could be more costly, of course. This one idea that the council, that staff wanted to propose to the council, is for the city to possibly provide one-time grant funds. They could be matching funds, they could be funding to provide the entire investment, just to help businesses in this transition to be moving more towards an outdoor dining environment. So again, if any business wanted to come forward, we would have an expedited review to get them through the process faster and make that transition quicker. So those are the four strategies staff wanted to bring to the council attention this evening. Moving on to the next slide, we wanted to bring these forward tonight and to have the council be able to react to these, to provide your comments, your input, your questions. And also, if the council was amenable, we are asking for your adoption of a resolution that would allow the city manager and our staff to be able to move forward now on these strategies, particularly ones that could involve encroachment into the public right-of-way. Having such a resolution is an important authorization to allow us to move forward now, given the temporary nature of these public health orders. And again, we're bringing this to you tonight because we wanted to get started now and not wait until the next council meeting on August 17th. The temporary permits will be issued within 48 hours of getting a complete application from applicants and valid through the extent of the state public health order, which at this point seems to be quite long lasting. Our goal is to work diligently with the chamber, with whom we've already been having great conversations around this concept, to help us get interest from businesses in these applications and to really help promote the use of outdoor spaces within our community. Lastly, I'll note that staff did consider other strategies as part of this approach that we wanted to illustrate to the council. However, we felt that these three listed on screen here were not as immediate as the four that we identified earlier. These three on screen are outdoor dining in city parks, using pop-up spaces for dining or activities, and then temporary street closures for pedestrian access and expanded dining. We felt that these could be considered, but they weren't as immediately tangible or implementable as the other strategies that we identified here previously. Lastly, I'll just say that for the cost and funding for this, Wendy, next slide, please. We would be open to considering ways for the city to help fund these different items, particularly with parklets and grant funding. We are proposing to the council that we would use up to $50,000 of the $160,000 that we're receiving from the CARES Act funding to help support these outdoor efforts. For example, $20,000 could be used to help fund parklets, which could fund two parklets at $10,000 apiece. We could also use the balance to help fund these matching grant funds for businesses making the transition to permanent outdoor space, or the council could consider a different allocation based on its interests. I will note lastly that we will plan to return to the council at a later meeting on spending the remaining funding of the CARES Act. We don't have a plan coming before you this evening for spending the remaining portion of these funds. We are working on that right now, and we'll bring that back to you at the next council meeting. So with that, I will yield the floor and take the council's questions and comments.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Brunson, for that discussion. Let's see if we have any questions. We'll start with Councilmember Lance.
Thank you for that work. It's great to be proactive, and you obviously don't know how long it lasts, but I honestly don't have any questions.
Hold on, Councilmember Lance. I'm getting a lot of feedback. Do we know where that might be coming from? Go ahead and speak again, Desi, just to see if it's resolved itself, please.
Testing.
Oh, very good. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that.
I was just going to say it was a very thorough report, so I don't have any questions. I'm just looking forward to our dialogue. Thank you.
Very good. Councilmember Shaw, any questions?
I have a couple. I know our grant program was very popular, and we're going to talk about the rest of the funds in the future, but I don't want too much money to go to this and then to find out later we couldn't do grants or any grants again. Is one going to come at the expense of the other?
That's a fair question. I would say that we could very, very likely have another grant program coming forward again. $160,000 does provide us with some opportunities to do some different programs. Just as a reference, the city of San Luis Obispo is spending its portion of the CARES Act funding in a roughly similar way. They're spending about a third of it for outdoor programs and then the balance for their grant program, which they're just starting now, along with some other programs as well. So I think if we were looking at up to a third for this particular program, and we could scale that down if council wished, I think we still have a good amount of money for another round of grant programs.
Okay. And I just wondered, and I think Ms. Brennan from the chamber is going to be here too, maybe. I just wondered if we had gotten feedback from business owners as to what they would want or they would find most helpful, especially just I'm debating parklets or would they rather have a street closure? You know, have business owners given feedback?
I will ask Ms. Brennan to be able to comment on that either now through the council or during public communications. I will just mention that in terms of street closures, the experience I've heard from San Luis Obispo and other communities is that has been scaled down in part because of concerns from business owners about loss of parking, loss of access. So that was one of the reasons why we wanted to raise that as an issue, but not focus on it as a strategy right now, because it has been complex in communities that have considered it. But I'll invite Ms. Brennan to be able to speak to that more.
Okay. And I just had one question.
And I was going to say, I do understand that Jocelyn is on the line. So if with the council's availability, or whatever the correct word would be, let's go ahead and see if Jocelyn has an opportunity just to complete that the city manager's thought. Ms. Brennan, are you able to join us?
Yes, Jocelyn Brennan here. Hello, Mayor Lee and Council. I will just give a couple anecdotal answers to the street closure question, although we haven't taken an official poll or sign up from our businesses. But in San Luis Obispo, they did close several streets. And from what I understand, the restaurants appreciated it, but the retailers found that they felt it was actually, they were losing sales with the street closed. And so since we do have a similar mix on our streets of retail and restaurants, they think that a full closure wouldn't be recommended because it could hurt those retailers. In Paso, they also have decided not to close any streets and just in some sections due to parklets, but in other sections close one lane. And so not doing a full closure, but rather just closing one lane to allow for more room. So I'm not sure if that answers the question, but that's just what we've heard from some of the other communities that have gone before us on this outdoor operations.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's helpful to me. I had a follow-up on that. Have you heard from business owners about the parklet idea? Do they like that? Because I'm wrestling a little bit with the fact that they seem to cost $10,000 each, but really they would only benefit the business owners that were immediately near the parklet. So I'm trying to figure out, is that fair, or do they share them, or how does that work?
Right. And so again, the city of Flores really were the first ones out of the gate on this, and so we're learning a lot from them. What they are allowing is the businesses to request a parklet, and then they have the responsibility on them to talk to their neighbors. And if their neighbors are in agreement, they can also benefit from it, even if they're a retailer. But what their city staff has shared with me is that some of the retailers did like a one-day sidewalk sale where they all put everything outside, and they really liked doing it for that one day. But they don't all have enough staff for someone to keep an eye outside on the merchandise that they would put out, you know, maybe on the parklet, and also to be able to be staffed on the indoor area. And so what they have found more is that some of the restaurants have asked their neighbors, can we extend our parklet in front of your area as well? And that has been working out for certain neighbors.
Okay, and I just had one more question that would probably be best for Ms. Brennan. Have you heard any feedback from people in the beauty industry about anything specific that they need? Would they want to do special things in the park, or is there anything that they need from us specifically?
Yeah, so you know, it's a challenge. They're happy that they have the option now to be able to operate outdoors is what I'm getting from the personal services industry and the salons. But it is challenging to do that outdoors, although we do see businesses doing that in Flow as well. And I don't know, I don't think we have a picture of it. We might need to go take one. But they have figured out a way to put something around the base of their salon chair outside that traps the hair when they're doing haircuts. And so it's working. So I do think that they would appreciate the option to be able to do it. And then if they don't have an immediate option, you know, in front or, you know, in back or to the side of their brick and mortar location, you know, we have offered to work with other businesses that either might have the parklet option that works for their location or maybe has a parking lot that's underutilized and maybe a salon could set up a tent in their space and kind of have an outdoor salon at a neighbor's property. I haven't gotten much feedback on the park idea, but that's certainly something that that we could explore. I think there's a lot of logistics to doing something, you know, possibly in the park where, you know, if it stays up overnight, it would need to be secured and things like that. So there's a lot of details that would need to be worked through. But I definitely can confidently say that there is an interest in being able to move their operations outdoors near their location.
Okay, thank you. I just had one more question. It's probably best for City Manager Bronson. With the parklets, to me, they're pretty costly. Will they remain after COVID or do they go away?
So the short answer is that we would have them in our possession. Now, after the state public health order was lifted, then we would have to remove them from the location or revise the findings to be able to create a permanent home for the parklet, like a number of cities have done. So what's before the council right now is just a temporary application tied into the public health guidance. But this would be, in fact, something that we would have and be able to deploy at different locations once we actually invest in this. And so there is that longevity that we would have by investing in this.
All right, thank you. Those are all my questions.
Very good. Let's see if Mayor Pro Tem Bright has any questions.
Well, I did. I think Miriam's asked most of them. I was very interested in if there would be some way that we could incorporate other businesses aside from restaurants being able to use the parklet somehow or that they would be able to utilize them somehow. And then also having the ability for more than one business to use the parklet. So that's really my question, how they would be used, and is there some idea of possibly where you're thinking you might put the first two?
Sure. I'll take second question first. We're still looking at different possibilities, and I would say, while Grand Avenue is our main commercial corridor, putting a parklet right on Grand Avenue, given the lanes, given the traffic, given the rate of speed, may not be the ideal location, but perhaps a side street right around the corner from Grand Avenue, where there is less traffic, could be a location that still has it in a high visibility area, but has it in a spot that's more appropriate for having people be able to be in the parking space. So that's one possibility there, whether it's 3rd Street or 10th Street, somewhere in our commercial core, I think we have a great opportunity to test out how this application could be used. And I think to your first question, and building on the responses to Councilmember Shaw's questions, parklets are also spots that you can have for seating as well. They're being used in a number of communities as outdoor seating spots, not just dining locations, but seating locations. And those could be helpful for getting takeout food, maybe not tied to one particular restaurant, but just tied to being able to sit outside but take something from takeout and be able to use this outdoor space that isn't there now. So those are some of the applications of parklets as well that are being used. And I think tying it into this temporary COVID-19 health environment could be beneficial.
Very good. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, everyone, for their questions. And I just had a couple follow-ups from, I think, Councilmember Shaw's question. So with the parklets, does it become... And I apologize, Mayor Pro Tem Bright, you froze there for a second. Did you have another question?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks. So for the city manager then, so once, let's say we went down the path of parklets, so those would be city-owned, correct? And so post-COVID situations, whether we turned them into seating areas or some other use, they would be as a city property?
That's correct. If we were investing in the funds to install them, then they become city property and used at our disposal. If we had them in a more permanent location, again, we have to modify the findings to be able to allow them.
Okay, very good. And then more of a confirmation question, just for anyone who might be listening or tracking along. We had a conversation last meeting about approximately $105,000 or $106,000 of grant fundings. And this $160,000 is a different grant program, correct?
That's correct. The $105,000 that the council acted upon last week was tied into CDBG funding that really was designed for more social human services needs. This is tied to the CARES Act, but it's more of a block grant to the city for expenses tied into COVID-19. And so our share on a per capita basis is $160,000. The money has to be spent by December 31st, and it's really tied into COVID purposes in general. We just recently received these funds, and so we're trying to sort through different uses. And again, one potential use that we thought of was some funding to help support these outdoor transition, knowing that we have another round of micro grants that we could do and other purposes as well.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that confirmation. So then let's go see if there is anyone on the line besides Ms. Brennan who wants to make public communications. And if you do want to call in, please call in at 805-321-6639 if you'd like to provide public comment. And I will open it up to our city clerk and see first if Ms. Brennan does want to make some public comment on this item. So we appreciate her opportunity to answer some questions, but she might want to provide public comment as well.
I do. Thank you for the opportunity. I just wanted to, again, Jocelyn Brennan here from the South County Chambers of Commerce. I did want to just thank the council for being flexible and willing to consider this evening and say that we're here to partner and help in any way that we can. Some of the businesses cannot make ends meet on just takeout or just a few outdoor seats that they have. So it might not seem like a big difference to add three or four more seats, but to them it is. And it really does help them. And then again, also, as Councilmember Shaw mentioned, some of these other businesses that have to operate outdoors now, like the salons, you know, if they aren't able to operate outdoors, then they're completely closed. So so I thank you for considering it this tonight and look forward to helping assist in any way that we can. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for those comments. Let's see from City Clerk Sims if there's anyone else on the line that wants to speak on this item.
No, we have no one else on the line.
Very good. Thank you for that. I will go ahead and close public comment on this item and bring it back to the council for discussion and possible action. So, Councilmember Shaw, let's have you go first.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about. I want this, no matter how we do it, to be very guided by the business owners, because I feel that I need to hear what they need. For example, I don't want to say we're creating three parklets and then hear later, well, not all of us could use it, or, and I'm not really sure if like the overflow seating for takeout is necessary. When we take out, we just go home. And I would hate for them to be there vacant. I really liked the idea of possibly matching grant funding, like if people want to do permanent improvements and us being able to maybe match some of their spending, because that's something that's even going to last and be great for their business going forward. So that's, I like that idea. I also thought, I like the idea of possibly one lane street closures, like not on Grand Avenue, but maybe, for example, I'm thinking on Third Street, or, you know, in each of the business nodes, like maybe one of the smaller minor streets, like maybe 9th or 10th or 3rd, maybe one lane closure to improve seating. But I guess for me, I'm just a little torn because our business area and our restaurants are just so unique that I would like the business owners to approach us with their needs. And so maybe it's as simple as us creating a fund and they come and approach us for needs. I'm just not sure how to put my thoughts into action. So I'll be interested. Hopefully you all have some ideas.
Very good. Next we'll go to Councilmember Lance.
I agree. I think that just sticking a parklet where we think it may be beneficial is not the approach. And I don't know if that's the intention. I think I would be supportive of an approach. I really like the idea of parklets, especially ones that are aesthetically pleasing, not the white kind of construction barrier looking ones. But I think, as Councilmember Shaw mentioned, I would be supportive of an approach where we say, hey, this is an option to our business community, but please come to us with your interest instead of us using staff time to kind of scope out and ask businesses, you know, will you use this parklet? Will you use this parklet? You know, or just putting it there, hoping that the business would use it. It'd be great if maybe our approach is, okay, we're willing to do these parklets. We're willing to add additional seating for restaurants, but please come to us if you think that this is going to be beneficial for your business. Maybe it's in a messaging, you know, kind of approach. I'm not sure how we would go about doing that. And maybe no businesses would come forward. Maybe nobody would think it was an appropriate approach for their business. But at least maybe at that point, as a council, we could have said, okay, we're supportive of this if a business reaches out to us and set, you know, makes a point that it's going to be beneficial for them. So I don't know. That's kind of my thought on the parklets. As far as everything else, I think whatever we can do to expedite encroachment permits and temporary use permits for businesses that are able to use private property and even public property without, you know, making it a risk factor for people walking and whatever. I'm supportive of the first three approaches. So, yeah, I don't know if that cleared anything that anybody was thinking of, but that's where my head's at.
Very good. Thank you for those comments. Let's see if Mayor Pro Tem Bright has anything to share.
You know, I'm really in agreement with what my colleagues have said. I certainly don't want to go forward with anything that really may not be beneficial, because really our intent here is to be productive and help our businesses go forward. So I like the idea of allowing them to tell us what they need. So and I'd really like to make sure that we're able to assist all areas of the business community. So I'm supportive of certainly of the first three areas, allowing the city manager to go forward and to allow the temporary permits to be approved in 48 hours and to work with the chamber and those things. So I am certainly
very much in favor of aesthetically pleasing parklets, if in fact that is what that's what our business community wants. So I guess I haven't really added much, other than I am really concerned about our businesses that have to work outside but can't at this point in time. So I'd really like to see, make sure that we are able to assist them as well. So I guess that's...
Okay. So I appreciate all that input. Let's see if we can kind of craft that into some good direction for staff. I think I'm hearing consensus that we definitely want to support the expansion of the commercial uses in outdoor spaces, including dining spaces, public and or private parking lots, as well as public sidewalks. So I think that's good consensus there. I think the everybody's in support of the expeditious way that staff is committed to reviewing applications and so forth as they come forward within the 48 hours. So definitely appreciate that. So I guess the question becomes for the city manager. So realizing I'm hearing from the council, myself included, that the parklets are a great idea. We're not sure if they are going to be as productive in Grover Beach as they might be in other locations, just based upon our situation or locations of our commercial businesses and our retail and our resident or restaurants. But I don't think we want to take it off the table. And so if a restaurant or a private business comes forward and says, hey, I'd like to consider a parklet, I think perhaps there's flexibility in the amount of funding that could go towards that. So let me throw something out and see if the council concurs. Everything that's been shared with via the city manager tonight, I think, is acceptable to the council in the resolution, which means I think the resolution is necessary for the use of public rights of way. Is that correct, Mr. City Manager?
That's correct. The resolution is general about just authorization to use the right of way. It is not specific to any particular tool, but just a general authorization that we're seeking.
Okay, so I think, is there anyone who has a concern with the resolution? Okay, yeah. So I'm kind of seeing a straw poll that ultimately we'll make a motion to proceed with the resolution. So I think the question becomes is how best to use the $160,000 of the CARES Act funding. And so what's before us tonight is, from a staff standpoint, is a use of $50,000 of the funding for some fashion or some method that the restaurants or the outdoor businesses see as their best opportunity to be successful. So perhaps that's what the direction we give tonight is, based upon the staff report, we allocate $50,000 of the $160,000 toward staff and the chamber to say, you have shown us the trust to be able to spend this wisely. You've laid out three or four different opportunities for that. Continue with that trust and bring it back to the council for kind of a report, either at the 17th or at the next opportunity. Is that a approach that the council could support?
Yes, I'm wondering, would we want to have a council member on the committee, kind of like we did with the grant committee, just so, because I would think, because especially with the gap in the meeting, we would want to be able to move forward before August 17th. Or how would we, or would we just say city manager and chamber go with the $50,000, and how would that work?
Actually, I would be supportive of having a council member on that that committee as well, just to kind of be a kind of a liaison for that, unless there's thoughts to the contrary.
Well, isn't Desi is already our liaison with the chamber now. Would Desi?
Would you be willing to continue on this next level of ad hoc?
Yeah, I guess my question is, I don't necessarily know would it, you know, what you envision the just the decision in allocating that money towards those businesses? Is that kind of okay? Yeah, that's fine.
Perhaps it looks like the city manager would like to expand upon that.
Yeah, just maybe a question for clarity. By saying committee, what we were envisioning is not so much a committee kind of going forward and helping implement this, but to work for the city staff and for the chamber to work together on approaching businesses even more than we already have and seeing what works for them and begin putting these funds in action immediately. The one area where there may be a true committee could be this idea of a matching grant fund for businesses with the permanent outdoor space, where we would have a very quick application process, much like we had with the previous micro grant. So that could be a spot for Councilmember Lance to be able to assist in, as she did in the last micro grant process, so that we had a few different reviewers looking at applications and being able to provide feedback there. So if that was amenable to the council, we could have that be a conduit, and then staff would report back to the full council on how the additional spending was proceeding in implementing this direction from the council.
Then any concerns with that approach?
I don't have any concerns. I just, as I'm thinking about it, the way I would see it is a press release or a communication goes out to all the business owners with the help of the chamber that kind of says, you know, kind of takes a summary of your report. These are some ideas: one lane road closure, permanent grant matching, parklet. Now come to us with your needs and tell us what you need. And I just want us to go on record that I want people to be as creative as they can. You know, I don't want us saying no to something that's going to help a business owner right now, unless it's a matter of life and death. So that would be my directive.
And that's exactly why we're bringing this item to the council this evening, was to try to help get that conversation going. Our business community is wonderful. They are doing so much great work. They're also very focused. They're very kind of head down, making ends meet. And so we wish to we'll engage them even further than we have. We haven't heard a lot, but we will take every step we can to help making sure we reflect their interest. And I think with the parklets, again, we can consider that as a possible use based on what we hear from the business community and based on what we share from other communities around here. So I think it's, to the mayor's point, it is a strategy that could be used if it's applied in the right spot with businesses being interested in going forward and actually using it. So I think having that in our toolbox does make sense.
Okay, so from that perspective, it sounds like we have consensus to move forward with up to $50,000 of the CARES funding, and for the business community to be as creative as possible, and our chamber and our city staff to do what they always do, which is find a way to say yes. Okay. Okay, great. So short of the consideration of the resolution, is there anything else, Mr. City Manager, that kind of needs guidance from or policy from the council?
No, sir. I'll just add to Mayor Pro Tem Bright's comments about the hair salons, other businesses that can't work indoors. We are working with about half dozen different hair salons right now on outdoor usage. So while a lot of this discussion is around dining and restaurants, we are working diligently with the hair salons and barbershops and other services to help them make this transition as well. So just to know that your staff is working diligently to help businesses make that transition as well.
Thank you. I know you are, and we appreciate that. Thank you.
Very good. So unless there's any other topic of discussion prior to somebody making a motion on the resolution, if anybody just wants to raise their hand and add anything else, or someone want to make a motion.
I'll make a motion that we approve a resolution authorizing the city manager to approve temporary closures of public rights of way for the safety and protection of the public who use the public rights of way.
I'll second that.
Very good. City Clerk Sims, roll call, please.
Councilmember Shaw.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Yes.
Councilmember Lance.
Yes.
Mayor Lee.
Yes. Very good. So is there any other discussion on that topic this evening that anybody has? Very good. And then we'll consider that matter closed for this evening. And I'll turn to City Clerk Sims, see if there's any members of the public still on the line who might want to speak under public communications.
No, there's no one on the line.
Very good. Thank you for that. So, City Manager, City Attorney, anything that you need to add or update before we adjourn?
No, sir.
Not from my office.
Very good. Thank you, everyone. So we do have a special meeting at 6 p.m., a joint meeting between the Council and the Planning Commission. So I will adjourn this meeting, and we'll see you back here at 6 p.m. And just a confirmation from the City Clerk, that is a separate invite, correct?
Yes, it is.
Very good. Then we'll go ahead and adjourn this meeting and see you all back in 10 minutes. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Everybody is in the process of coming on board. I think I see so far three planning commissioners and two council members.
Yes.
And then some consultants, some staff.
Pencil and paper.
You can use that paper.
We are waiting on Councilmember Shaw.
Very good. And as we are waiting for Councilmember Shaw to come through, I'll just kind of say hello to everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight. If you would do us the favor, if you're not actively speaking, go ahead and put yourself on mute. So that way we do limit the amount of reverb or backfeed from your speakers. And what I've done in the past at council meetings, and I was intending to do tonight, unless we find that it works better some other way, is I'll call on people individually, and so that'll give you an opportunity to unmute yourself. If you do have to say in the middle of someone else's question, go ahead and wave or something, and I'll come to you as soon as possible from that perspective. Okay.
And Mayor Lee, you know that Commissioner McLaughlin will not be joining us tonight, so we only have three planning commissioners.
Yes, and I did get that email. Thank you for that. Appreciate that. And so it looks like everyone is here. So City Clerk Sims, I'll kind of confirm with you that you're ready to go and that AGP is ready to go.
We are ready to go.
Very good. Then I will call to order this special meeting and this joint meeting of the City Council and the Planning Commission of the Grover Beach, of the City of Grover Beach, for this Monday, July 27th at 6 p.m. This call to order is done in compliance with state and county shelter at home orders, which means our meetings will be held by teleconference until further notice. This meeting can be viewed on Channel 20 and is available on live streaming on the city's website as well as slow-span.org. And members of the public may provide public comment during the meeting by calling area code 805-321-6639. And that phone line is open now. So with that, City Clerk Sims, if you would do a roll call, please.
Councilmember Lance.
Here.
Councilmember Shaw.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Oop, I don't think we heard you, Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Here.
Mayor Lee.
Here.
Commissioner Halverson.
Here.
Commissioner Holden.
Here.
Commissioner McLaughlin is not available. Chair Rodman.
Here.
Very good. Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. Just want to say thank you for the opportunity to get together. It's always good to, when the council and any committee that we have, especially our planning commission, can get together and share ideas and have a good presentation on something that's vitally important to our community, such as housing. And looking forward to a very good, robust conversation. I will go ahead and start the meeting by public communications, where anyone has the opportunity to call in at 805-321-6639 if anyone would like to provide any public comment this evening. So City Clerk Sims, is there anyone who wants to speak under public communications tonight?
No, there's no one on the line at the moment.
Very good, thank you. Then I will go ahead and close public comment and bring it back to our workshop setting. And so I'll turn it over to Community Development Director Buckingham, and he can lead the next steps. Thank you.
Good evening, Mayor. I'm going to just turn this over to Associate Planner Reese.
Good evening, City Council and Planning Commission. Can you all hear me okay? Okay. The city's housing element is one of 8 state-mandated elements of the general plan, and it's required to be reviewed and certified by HCD periodically. The current housing element was adopted in 2014, and the next cycle of the housing element, which is what we're going to be discussing tonight, covers from December of this year to December of 2028, and it must be adopted before the end of the year. A state housing element law requires that each city identify and analyze existing and projected housing needs within their jurisdictions, and prepare goals and policies and programs to help further development, improve, and preserve housing. The housing element is intended to outline goals and policies consistent with the city's general plan and adopted council goals, in addition to addressing state laws and other requirements. The city contracted with PlaceWorks to update the housing element, and the process started with a public workshop back in February to receive public input on housing issues. PlaceWorks and staff has been working on preparing the draft housing element, which is the topic of tonight's discussion. Amy Schinsheimer of PlaceWorks will be providing an overview of the draft housing element tonight. Following tonight's review and input, the element will be submitted to HCD for initial review and comment, and then we'll end up incorporating their comments in the final draft. The public can continue to provide input over the next couple of months during HCD's review of the draft and during the preparation of the environmental document. The process will culminate with the Planning Commission meeting in October and then council meeting in November to consider the adoption of the final housing element. And then that final document will go to HCD for final certification before the end of the year. And with that, Amy Schinsheimer.
Thank you, Janet. Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? Great. I'm Amy Sinsheimer. I work with PlaceWorks, as Janet mentioned, and we're pleased to be assisting the city with the housing element update. Next slide, please. So we're going to talk today about a couple things.
get started with some overview of the demographic information that is in part of your housing element in the technical report and some of the things that stood out there. We will also talk about the numbers that the city is required to plan for in terms of housing units, and we'll get into the details of that. We'll touch upon one of the newer state laws that is called the No Net Loss Law. We'll talk about the regional process that's been happening with the county and all of the cities in the county to plan for housing and work on housing planning together. We'll touch on the new programs in your housing element and then talk about your schedule moving forward. And then we'll open it up for comment and council and planning commission comment. I can't see the slides anymore. Can everyone else? Okay, there we go. So I'll wait till they're back up, and if we could advance to the housing element overview slide, slide number four. So this is the agenda that I just mentioned, and then if you want to continue to two more slides.
So we appear to be having a little bit of a technical difficulty with the slide pack. So is that, here we go.
Great. So yeah, just to start out with a little overview of the housing element process. For those that aren't familiar, this is one of your general plan elements. As Janitor Bruce mentioned, there are 8 required elements of the general plan that every city and county in California prepares. The housing element is required to be reviewed by the state, as Janet mentioned, so it's a little bit unique in that way. There are other elements that require some review. This one goes through a comprehensive review and certification with the State Department of Housing and Community Development. It does look at your existing and projected need for housing and needs surrounding housing. So what has changed since the last time you updated your housing element in 2014, and are there any notable things there that would drive the needs of housing for housing in your community? And so there has been a lot that's happened in the last 5 years. So we'll touch on that in the housing element, and we'll present a little bit on that in your slides tonight. We look at where housing is allowed in your community in terms of, you know, maybe vacant land, but also other ways that housing can be allowed by redeveloping certain sites possibly, or looking at other types of housing that can be counted in your housing element towards the regional need numbers. And we'll get into the details of that. We look at what did you want to do in your last housing element to achieve the goals surrounding housing in the community, and what programs were included, and how have things gone in terms of achieving the implementation of those programs. So there's actually a table in the housing element that reviews that, and we report back to the state as part of the housing element, and the city staff report back once a year as well. That's a requirement from the state. Then once we look at, you know, what are the needs currently, what is the housing need number that the city is required to plan for, and what are the programs that are the highest priority currently in 2020? And all of that comes together to form your implementation piece of your new housing element, and that will guide planning through 2028 for housing. And so that's a key piece of your element that is near the front of the draft document. As Janet mentioned, the deadline to adopt a housing element for the jurisdictions in San Luis Obispo County is December 31st, 2020.
And that means that if you do adopt by that date and have an element that can be certified by the state, then you stay in compliance. You're eligible for various funding sources, as well as having a general plan that is in compliance, which is part of state law. Next slide, please. There's still an issue with the slides, so once we can, we'll get into the next section on community demographics.
And just City Clerk Sims, just to make sure we're clear, are we having a, oh, there we go. I think we have it advanced now. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So as I mentioned, we'll touch on some of the demographic information that is reported in the updated draft housing element and some of the things that were more notable, but also just kind of to cover a broad spectrum of what's included in the draft. So in terms of population, in 2019, according to the Department of Finance, the population in Grover Beach was 13,533. There is, based on projections that SLOCOG has done, a projected 15% increase between 2010 and 2050. The age group that seems to have had the biggest decrease since 2010 is the 45 to 54-year-old age group, while the 85-plus age group has increased more than any other group. We will note that we're using the best available data currently, which is ahead of the 2020 census. So a lot of the data that is in here for, you know, the last couple of years, which is most current that we can use, is an estimate. So sometimes the trends are not as certain as they are from, say, if we were able to say from 2010 to 2020. So we are using the data that has been pre-approved by the state for the most part, and to the best available right now. So next slide, please. This slide shows a snapshot of household income for Grover Beach, and the median income shown here is actually countywide. That's what's used in the housing element, and it is updated every year. So there are new 2020 numbers that were just released, I believe, in June. So it has actually gone up by about $10,000. That is definitely going to be impacted, I believe, by the pandemic. So we'll probably see an adjustment in 2021. So 2019 may be as good of a number to use this point, but that was what was available when the draft was created. The affordable home sale price in terms of the median household is $451,880, and affordable rent is $2,122. And then that's broken down, that below that is what's actually data that's been gathered on costs. So from the SLO Association of Realtors, the 2019 median home value in Grover Beach was $549,563, and then some median rent numbers that were gathered from actual rental prices locally. Next slide, please. So this slide looks at households that are paying more than 30% of their income for housing costs. So whether you're a renter or a household that owns your own home, there is a certain amount of cost or your income that is considered to be fair to pay for housing. If you're paying more than 30%, then that can be a real strain on the household, and they may actually trade off, you know, buying other things or spending other money in order to cover their housing costs. So 42% of all households in Grover Beach were overpaying at the time this data was gathered, and 52% of renters were overpaying, 28% of owners were overpaying. So that shows you the overpayment information. Next slide, please. So the type of housing units in Grover Beach is predominantly single-family homes, 72% as of 2019. 42% of those were owner-occupied, and 58% were renters. One thing that was notable in terms of that data was that in the county as a whole, 60% of households were owner-occupied, while 42% in Grover were. So that's a pretty significant difference from the general percent countywide. Next slide, please. The city just conducted a survey of conditions of existing housing units in the city, and this happens periodically to qualify for funding to do rehabilitation of housing and also to include in the housing element and other demographic information. So more than half of the housing units in the city were built prior to 1980. And of all of the housing units, less than 1% are in need of rehabilitation. 8% of the housing units are vacant, but of those that are vacant, 81% of those are used for seasonal, recreational, or occasional use. And that is that 81% is an increase from 53% in 2010. So that's another notable statistic that we found. Next slide, please. There is a section of the demographics that looks at special housing needs, and that is certain groups of people that the state has identified have a harder time finding housing or a harder time affording housing. That includes folks with disabilities, those who are seniors or elderly, single-parent households, the homeless, and several other groups. And so we have some high points from that section as well. You'll note here there's some information about those who have disabilities, including those who have a developmental disability. And special data is collected for that group. And there are also certain programs and resources that are available for those with developmental disabilities. Next slide, please. So 20% of the households are headed by someone 65 years or older, while 14% of the total population is 65 years or older. Female-headed households were 17% of the population, or female-headed households with children, and 5% of those households were below the poverty line. 67 people were experiencing homelessness in Grover Beach as of the point in time count that occurred at the beginning of 2019. And we would note that 34% of those folks in Grover Beach did have some type of shelter, while countywide only 21% had some type of shelter. Next slide, please. I want to talk now about the Regional Housing Needs Allocation, or the RHNA. This is the number that the state allocates to every city and county in California. And in most areas, including our area, the state first works with the regional planning organization. In our case, that's San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, or SLOCOG, to allocate an overall number to the region. And you can go to the next slide, please. And then SLOCOG works with the cities and the county to allocate that overall number to each of the jurisdictions. So that process started a couple years ago and was concluded in the summer of 2019 when SLOCOG adopted the RHNA plan, which includes the final numbers for each of the jurisdictions. And what this means is that each city and the county need to look at where housing is allowed to be developed in their community. And that is mostly through looking at the zoning code, taking a look at the sites that are available, whether they're vacant, non-vacant, and what type of housing they allow. So whether they allow single family housing, mixed use, projects that include residential, other multifamily housing, and anything in between, live work units, and where that is possible. So in Grover Beach, we've been working with the city staff to take a look at that. And the numbers that you can see across the top there in the first top row are the numbers for the city of Grover Beach. And the SRENA number is divided out by income categories. So it starts with the folks who make the least and goes up to the folks who make the most. Extremely low income is 30% of median income. So that 87,000 income number that we talked about a couple slides ago, that would have been the number for 2019 for the county, which applies to all of the jurisdictions. So if you are a household that makes 30% of that, you're in the extremely low category, 30% or less, between 30% and 50%. 31 and 50% is the very low. 51 to 80% is the low. 80% to 120% is the moderate. And then above moderate is market rate housing, so anything above 120%. So the city is expected to plan for all of these different income categories. And the way that that translates in the housing element is by looking at what type of densities are allowed on sites, and also looking at other options. And in the case of Grover Beach, we looked at accessory dwelling units, and we actually worked with the county, and the county produced a report on the affordability and availability of accessory dwelling units in all of the jurisdictions in the county. And the draft Grover Beach housing element relies on that report in order to estimate how affordable accessory dwelling units will be moving forward through these next 8 years, and then also how many might be permitted or constructed. So that is the third row down where it says ADUs anticipated. Excuse me just 1 second. Excuse me, my dog just opened my door. we went through this analysis. We were able to look at also any units, including accessory dwelling units, that had been permitted already or constructed already in the city since the beginning of 2019. And those are listed there in the first two rows below the RENA. So the city is able to actually take credit for those first three rows below the RENA in terms of meeting their numbers for this time frame. So that is some positive reporting there. And then we get to the vacant land inventory row. And this is actually where we started looking at sites that are available for housing in the city that are vacant. So as you can see, there were some sites available to address the moderate and above moderate income categories. And these two categories are where lower densities are allowed, or where higher densities above 20 units per acre are not allowed. And so it's all those zones that allow residential in those lower density categories. And moderate is generally that medium density range. And then above moderate is your lowest density sites. So working with the staff, we were able to identify those sites, but we did not find a lot of opportunities for the lowest income categories. So that's the extremely low, very low, and low categories. So because state law has changed since the last time you updated your housing element, there are a lot more requirements to actually find sites that are appropriate for what we call the lower income categories, those three categories. And so without further analysis of sites that are not vacant or sites that don't already have zoning that's appropriate for the lower income categories, which would be 20 units to the acre or greater, we had to take a look at some other sites. So the last two rows there below the total row, the opportunity sites with adequate zoning and opportunity sites with proposed rezoning are where we identified the rest of the opportunities for the lower income RENA. And I'm going to get into the detail on where those units came from and the sites that go into those numbers on the next couple slides. But I will just end this one with the bottom row, the RENA surplus row. So that's showing that based on this analysis that's in the draft, the city would be able to address the RENA if all of the actions that are in the draft were continued forward to submit this approach to the state for their review. And we can go to the next slide.
Hey, Amy, if I can interrupt you, Mayor, members of the council, if we can just take a quick pause right now, and if you have any questions on all the information you've been provided, we'd be happy to answer some at this time.
And thank you, Mr. Buckingham. That was exactly what I was going to do. At Ms. Sinsheimer, that's you've had great slides so far. Let's see if there's that last one had a lot of information. Let's see if there's specific questions that anyone might have. I'll start with Planning Commission Chair Rotman. And go ahead and unmute yourself first, sir.
No, I do not have any questions at this point. Thank you for that opportunity, though.
Very good. And yeah, City Clerk Sims, if you could go back a slide, that would be helpful. So Commissioner Holden, so did you have any specific questions to this point?
I do not.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner Halverson.
Yeah, I just had one question. You know, the housing element talks about the tiny homes, the houses that are built on wheels, essentially, but they still have to hook up to water and sewer. Do those figure in here somewhere? Are those included in the ADU numbers?
Hi, this is Amy again. Tiny homes on wheels are not counted in those numbers. The way that the state law addresses those is that a local jurisdiction needs to specifically allow those in their zoning in order to count them. And there are some other requirements. Since they're not on a foundation, they're a unique housing type, but currently the city doesn't allow those, so that's where you're at. And if that is something that changes during the before 2028, then that is possible that the city could count them.
And okay. So just to clarify, Amy, the commission or the council just did approve tiny homes, so it'll take effect upon Coastal Commission approval here, but those will be an opportunity very shortly.
Okay, on chassis?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I was not aware of that. So, yes, there is a certain list of things that the city needs to make sure they're doing in order to count those towards your RENA numbers.
Okay, so right now the state does not allow us to count those toward RENA.
I would have to talk to the staff about whether or not everything's queued up to address that list of criteria. We haven't had that conversation. Yeah.
Okay. And then
allowing it in your local ordinance is a big step towards that being possible.
Sure. So one other question, the ADU numbers you have there for anticipated, you have 90 of them, for instance, under low income. These are relatively small dwellings. What would it take to get them down into the very low or extremely low categories?
Well, so this is based on the study that happened countywide, and that was based on all of the data we were able to gather, that for the most part, there were not a lot of ADUs that were affordable to anything below the low category. The good news for... there's two ways of talking about this. One is in terms of meeting the city's RENA. In terms of meeting the city's RENA, as you move forward through the planning period, you can count, if you have low income ADUs, that will address that part of your arena, and that's positive. If you're wanting to actually, make them more affordable, which I'm sure is part of the goal, to even lower income categories, that's where you're actually going to look for opportunities with folks who want to develop these kind of units to make them more feasible to develop for even less. So whether that's having pre-approved plans that are available so that people don't have to spend as much money when they build an ADU, or finding other ways to make the process easier and quicker so that it doesn't cost as much. I mean, those are some of the ways that we've seen other places in the state deal with that. But in terms of, what the state is looking for from the city, the fact that you have any ADUs in your lower categories is taking you, a good chunk of the way towards meeting your overall lower income arena. But the, extremely low versus very low versus low, that's more about, actually getting people into units that they can afford. And we can talk more about it if you want to get into some of those program ideas. Right now, we don't have a lot of those in your draft, but you could take a more aggressive approach to ADUs and have even more program ideas in there.
Okay. Well, I just was wondering where the state is going to take this and how critical they're going to be of those numbers when they're really looking for those lower categories as well. Thank you.
Yeah, I can actually respond to that part of the question a little bit more. So we've already worked with the state to review the Morro Bay housing element, and they also relied on this same study. So the affordability information has already been reviewed by HCD, and they've basically approved it through their review of that we've done with them with Morro Bay. And they've given guidance to all of the jurisdictions in California that if they have some sort of affordability work that they've done, data that they've gathered locally or regionally, and they have some track record of permitting ADUs, building and permitting ADUs, especially in the last couple of years since the state law became much more permissive, then there's an equation that we followed in order to come up with these numbers for City of Grover Beach. And we did not go, we took, basically the conservative approach in terms of the numbers. So we feel very comfortable about submitting these numbers to the state that they will be okay with them.
Very good. Thank you for those descriptions. And sounds like it could be a much larger discussion when it comes to the Planning Commission hearing in October as well. So let me turn to Councilmember Lance, see if she has any questions at this time.
Not at this time, thank you.
Very good. Councilmember Shaw.
I just had one about the 2020 census. I know we don't have the data yet. I'm not sure when the data comes in, but then does that affect this? Will there need to be adjustments, or do we just feel comfortable we go with these numbers?
Would you like me to respond?
Yes, please.
Okay. I believe the earliest that some of the data from the 2020 census will come out is possibly 2021, maybe 2022. I don't know if there's any definitive information on that yet, but that's my recollection from the 2010 census. And it's a decision point for the city. Everyone I'm working with, all the jurisdictions I'm working with, are moving forward with their housing elements because they are due at the end of this year. And so you would be probably out of compliance for a couple years if you waited for the data. But it is tricky timing.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Buckingham, did you want to share anything or add to that response?
No, thank you.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem Bright, did you have any questions?
No, thank you. I have no questions at this time.
Very good. And I just had one question in I think it kind of builds upon Commissioner Halverson's question. Is Mr. Buckingham mentioned that we did have an ADU ordinance that was recently adopted and has to go through the Coastal Commission. So where in the process do we insert that that documentation or that? Because obviously the goal this evening is to have a consensus to submit this in a draft form to HCD. Does that become one of our comments back from the state? Is incorporate any new ordinances, or how does that proceed?
Well, I believe there's a program in the draft element to update your ADU ordinance. And forgive me for I didn't know the detail about the tiny home chassis on a chassis, but yes, I knew that you had recently updated your ordinance, and it's going through the final steps of the process. And I believe we have current information in the draft about that. So, you know, once it has been completely adopted and certified by the Coastal Commission, then you would be able to report to HCD that you've finished that process. And I believe they want the ADU ordinances submitted to them as well.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for that that question break. And I guess notwithstanding the possibility of your dog having a question for you, we'll turn the presentation back over to you, Ms. Sinsheimer.
Thank you. So, yeah, now we want to talk a little bit more about the details of what's in your draft related to the sites for lower income housing. So this slide is an overview of 7 parcels, and they actually make up 6 sites. So 2 of the parcels are adjacent and are being considered together, and we'll talk about that when we get to that slide. Sorry that this map is fairly small. But we do have details for each parcel in the subsequent slides. So all of these sites have been carefully studied by the staff and the team and are considered suitable for multiple reasons for lower income housing. They are near transit, jobs, and shopping. Most of them are fairly close to Grand Avenue. And they do either currently or once the actions that are recommended in the draft housing element are taken, they would satisfy the density requirements for lower income household sites. So that would be 20 units to the acre or greater. And just to note that, you know, the reason that these 7 parcels are in this group are that they all have some additional analysis that was required beyond being just a purely vacant site that allows 30 dwelling units to the acre. And a lot of that is different from 2014 when you did your last housing element. There were many laws that were passed. I think we talked about them a little bit more at the workshop in February. Since 2014, the state has, as I'm sure most of you know, focused intensely on housing and how to deal with the shortage of housing, in particular affordable housing in our state. So there are these requirements that are new this time, and they require a lot more analysis. So for sites that are less than 1/2 acre, that one site that's in that category required some additional analysis. 6 out of the 7 parcels are what the state considers non-vacant, and so they required additional analysis. And then 5 of the 7 parcels would require some change to their zoning to allow that 20 units per acre. And altogether, these 7 parcels would provide at least 80 additional units based on the analysis. So that it meets and exceeds that lower income category that we're talking about. So next slide. And then one more. Thank you. So the first, what we're calling opportunity site, that are these 7 parcels, is at 144 North 3rd Street. It is non-vacant, and it would not require a change to the zoning to have the correct density to be included in this category, but it is non-vacant. So we had to take a look at, you know, why this site would be appropriate to redevelop with additional housing. It does have an existing duplex, and then the rest of the site is paved, and it does seem to be a good possibility of where more higher density housing could happen before 2028. And we've estimated that 12 units could be accommodated on this site. I'll just pause, and I don't know, Bruce or Mayor Lee, if you want to talk about each site as we go, or would you like me to go through this whole section first?
I'll let Mr. Buckingham respond, but I would just have you go through each of the sites individually. Or Mr. Buckingham?
I would agree.
Okay.
So we should talk about this one now? Or
no, Amy, just go through all of them, and then we'll take questions.
Oh, yeah. Correct. Okay. I think I misunderstood your... Yes, just please proceed.
Great. So we can go to the next slide. So the second opportunity site also would not require a change to zoning in order to allow 20 units per acre or greater. It is at 1206 West Grand Avenue, and it is also non-vacant. There is a commercial building on the site currently, and it's labeled number 2 on the map here. Some of the maps have more than one site shown on them. And I think those are the high points of this one. We can go on to the next slide. So the rest of the opportunity sites or parcels are in need of a change to the zoning in order to have the density that is required to include them. And so this one is at 191 South Oak Park Boulevard, and it is non-vacant. It has some older commercial development on the northern half. The other half is unimproved, so it is considered underutilized, and 18 units could possibly be accommodated on this site. Next slide, please. Opportunity site number 4 is at 809 Ramona, and it is shown here with site 5 on the map. They are close together, and this one could potentially accommodate 11 units. It would need a zoning change. It is currently public facility, and it has an older single family residence on it, and has also been identified as a good potential site. Next slide, please. Opportunity site number 5 is at 247 9th Street. This one is less than half an acre, so we have done some additional analysis in the draft housing element as to why this site would be a high potential for housing, partly because the owner has shown some interest, and we are estimating that 8 units could be accommodated on this site, and it would also need a zoning change to allow the densities required by the state. Next slide, please. The opportunity sites 6 and 7 are 2 parcels that are, one of them is surrounded by the other. You can see it here on the map, and it is owned by the city. This is the Cleaver site, and it has been put forward already as a potential site for housing, as most of you know, and it does need a zoning change in order to have the densities required by the state. But because of the fact that it's owned by the city and there's already this is already being looked at for affordable housing, it is considered a strong candidate site. Next slide, please. I want to touch briefly on one of the state laws that passed in 2017, no net laws. Yes.
Why don't we stop there and see if there's any questions on the opportunity sites.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for that. And perhaps one thing we can do as well, if you do have specific questions, go ahead and raise your hand. There's a raise your hand button on there. So, and I can call on you from that perspective. Otherwise, let's start this time with the council, and we'll go with Mayor Pro Tem Bright, see if she has any questions on the opportunity sites.
Thank you. And unfortunately, I don't have my raise my hand button here anymore.
Okay.
I don't know what's happened to it. Let's see. Regarding the opportunity sites, let's see. I did have one question, and that is regarding, the 191 South Oak Park site. I saw the letter from the owner There wasn't any specific mention of affordable housing in his letter. He mentioned residential construction, but so I'm just kind of wondering about that. Can anyone speak to that?
Yeah, Councilmember Bright. So first of all of these opportunity sites, there's no guarantee that affordable housing will be constructed on them. Certainly in the case of Cleaver, where the council is moving forward, very likely to be built with affordable housing. But any privately owned property, while they're identified as an opportunity site, no guarantee affordable housing will be developed. As the council has seen over the years, there's really only two ways 100% or affordable housing gets constructed in our city because we have such small lots. It's if a project takes a state density bonus and then in return for getting additional units, they actually have a small percentage of units that are set aside as deed restricted for low-income housing. And the most recent example of this would be the apartment project at 12th and Ramona. The only other way you typically get affordable housing development is through nonprofit developments, like People Self-Help Housing now moving forward on the Cleaver site, where through tax credits and subsidies, they're able to construct a project that obviously is providing below market rents. So those are the two ways we really provide affordable housing. These are identified as opportunity sites because that's what HCD calls them, and they certainly are opportunity sites. But I would just add that really any underdeveloped site on Grand Avenue is a potential opportunity site from the staff perspective. But again, the only way we end up with actually deed restricted affordable housing units are through taking that state density bonus or through developers like People Self-Help Housing. Does that help answer your question?
Well, I understand that, but there are other property owners who have actually have specified that they're interested in doing low-income housing or that sort of thing. So that was that was my question. You've answered it. Thank you very much.
There's actually, I guess, a second part to that real quickly, and that is the current zoning here only allows 9 units per acre with a retail commercial. Yes. And the state doesn't recognize that as an opportunity site. So by rezoning it to CBO, it does increase the density to 20 units per acre. So while it may be now more likely that the property owner move forward with a residential project because there's increased density, you are correct. There is no guarantee that property owner would develop affordable housing units. But it certainly does enhance the chance of providing housing in general.
Thank you.
Okay, looks like Councilmember Lance, you have a question as your hand is raised.
Yeah, thank you. My question is related to Opportunity Site 1 on Grand and 3rd. Just briefly, I know that some of the other sites are identified quite clearly because of the request for zone changes and letters from the owners about their intentions for their land. I was just curious if Opportunity Site 1 came about just by meeting some other criteria and elements and not necessarily because there was any interaction with the landowner.
In this particular case, there has been interaction with the landowner, but in this case, the landowner has actually a history of producing housing and not necessarily deed-restricted affordable housing, but has a preference to do small units, which may be affordable by design, if you will. So that's one reason this property was identified, because there is a track record of the property owner producing, quote, affordable housing.
Thank you. That's all.
Yep. Very good. Next, we'll go to Councilmember Shaw.
Thank you. No questions for me at this time. A couple of mine were answered. Thank you.
Very good. Next, we'll see if Commissioner Holden has any questions.
No, I have no questions.
Okay. Very good. Commissioner Halverson, did you have any questions?
No, I think we discussed my chief question about trying to guarantee that these will be built as low income, and I guess there are no guarantees. So thank you.
Very good. Chair Rodman, any questions?
Yes, just to clear up what I'm considering here is that, the background is many of these opportunity sites are parking lots or near parking lots or otherwise affecting density. So the time we would consider density and parking needs, educational needs, services, sewer needs, all of that would be when a proposal is submitted on any of these opportunity sites. We're just considering whether this is a possible site in order to use for low income. Am I clear on that?
That's correct. And as you note, the key here is that most of these opportunity sites actually need a rezone, and that's part of the direction we're seeking from the council tonight, is to move forward with the rezoning of those to comply or to be able to meet our RENA. And as you note, there's a couple that do not need rezones, but all of those project-related analysis will occur when a development application, if a development application, is ever submitted.
Understood. Thank you very much.
Very good. I think I don't have any questions except to ask, obviously this document provides opportunities and the developers or landowners within the community have to accept that opportunity in order for it to move forward. But I guess the question then centers around, is there still an opportunity for people to come forward and ask for this additional zoning and become an opportunity site? Or when would the cutoff for that be?
Right now, staff's identified these five lots, if you will, that need to be rezoned, and those would meet the RENA numbers. And so we're asking for your direction tonight to move forward to the rezone of those. Is actually part of the environmental document for the housing element update. So ultimately, the council could adopt a housing element and rezone those properties immediately, showing HCD that we've met our RENA. However, the council at any time can go ahead and we would recommend this be bifurcated, if you will, that you proceed with the four or five now, but that the council at any time could schedule another meeting or discussion for further input, and then you could direct staff to rezone additional properties, which would only further enhance the RENA. But we'd certainly do that. The preference would be to do that following the housing element update.
Okay, and that's ultimately because the opportunity sites get us to the numbers that we need to in order to show the state that we're meeting the intent of the RENA criteria, and then anything beyond that becomes an additional benefit, correct?
Correct. And also recall that with the exception of the retail commercial zone between 14th and Oak Park, all the other properties along Grand Avenue are currently zoned for 20 units per acre. So those, in essence, although HCD doesn't consider them opportunity sites for other reasons, they do have the ability to produce higher density housing.
Very good. Thank you for all that explanation. So seeing no other hands, we'll go ahead and turn it back over to Ms. Sinsheimer to continue with the next steps of the presentation.
Great. Thank you. So we can go to the next slide. So it's kind of segueing from what we were just talking about, what you were just talking about, in terms of having additional potential sites. There is a law that was passed in 2017 that does require all jurisdictions in the state to continue to look at the sites and the opportunities for housing throughout the housing element planning period after you've adopted your housing element. And if sites on your list in your housing element get developed with different numbers of housing units, or they are not at the income level in particular the lower income levels that are identified in your list, and then there need to be enough sites or opportunities for all of the different types of housing and the different RENA number levels that are required. So there's a lot that goes into this. Basically, you know, starting at the end of 2018, the city are able to count projects that are approved moving forward through the end of 2028. So you're continuing to do that, and that helps meet your RENA, but you also are continuing to look at this list of opportunities and sites as you move forward. And so, for example, if you have one of the sites that is designated for lower income develop for a different income category, it is important to still have enough opportunities or sites to develop units for that category. So that's one reason, particularly in that category, that the numbers in the slide that showed how we calculated all the math don't just meet that RENA number, but actually exceed it, so that you have some buffer. And that part of that is to address this law. So if the city does end up in a situation where you don't have the sites to continue to meet your RENA numbers, then the state law says that you will make up for that either by rezoning other sites, and that does need to happen within 180 days, or by possibly some other method, maybe possibly working on how you could provide more ADUs or the justification for that. The bottom line is hopefully you won't have to be in this situation. And so the idea is to continue to maintain sites. And if you see that there are applications coming in on your housing element sites and that they potentially will not be for the income categories that are listed in the housing element, it's important to keep looking for ways to keep up your inventory. And just the last thing on here is that this is the responsibility of the city. So a developer who owns or is the applicant on a housing element site is not responsible for building the exact number of units or the income category that's listed in the housing element. It is something that's up to the city to maintain a list of sites. So that's an important new law that was put in place since the last housing element. And we can go on to the next slide. So City of Grover Beach, along with the county and all of the other cities' planning staff, have been working together since last summer to work on a regional vision and regional approaches for addressing the housing needs in the county. And there is a section right before your local goals, policies, and programs that reflects some of the work that's happened so far. Each of the cities and the county have adopted, and we can go on to the next slide, what is called the Regional Compact. And so this is language that all of the local governments were able to agree on to work on the housing needs throughout the county. And this group and other staff are also working on a regional infrastructure and housing strategic action plan that's not completed yet, but that is to address the infrastructure needs that go along with increased housing and focused housing in certain areas where there is a lack of infrastructure. So that's something that is still being worked on and hopefully will be completed next year. And as part of this working group, the staff have been meeting at least once a month and came up with 6 shared goals that everyone can agree on, as well as 8 shared policies. So those are in the draft document. And the idea here is to work on immediate housing needs through sharing resources and tools that have worked in the different communities, but also to look to the future to ways that possibly regional housing planning can happen more. You've been listening to me talk about the RENA all night, and you know that is divided out by each jurisdiction. So while there are a lot of regional efforts and benefits happening already across many different programs for housing and other things. Each jurisdiction does have to address the RENA individually. So part of the goal of this group is to look at ways that there can be even more regional housing planning in the future, because I think, as we all know, everything is connected in our region in terms of jobs and the economies of each of the cities and the unincorporated county. And there are a lot of things that local government is responsible for. So if we can work together, it might help with that even more. So this is going to be an ongoing process. I think I already mentioned that. And we wanted to make sure that you know about that section of the draft and give us your feedback on it if you have any. Next slide, please. So every time the housing element is updated, there is a focus on looking at the programs that were included in the last element and what has been effective, what has turned out to maybe not be as appropriate as it was 5 years ago. We also look at any changes to state law and federal law, if appropriate, in looking at what programs are needed for this next update. So I'm going to highlight the programs that are substantially new since last time. There are quite a few other programs in there as well, but these are the ones that you do not have in your existing housing element. So next slide. So program 1.3 calls for taking a look at your emergency shelter overlay zone. This is a zone that was put in place in the last 10 years to address state law that does require every jurisdiction to allow for some areas of the city to allow emergency shelters without discretionary review. So taking a look at, you know, whether the areas that have been identified in that overlay are still appropriate and if there are any new areas that should be looked at. Program 1.5 addresses the city's compliance with the no net loss law that I just spoke about a minute ago. Program 1.6 is the program that goes along with the 7 parcels that are on the opportunity sites list in the draft. So this would actually be the action that would be taken to change the zoning on the 5 parcels that would need that if those move forward. So that's the detail there in that program. Program 1.7 is to comply completely with the State Employee Housing Act, and this is primarily related to farm worker and agricultural worker housing and making sure that that's allowed for in your zoning. Program 1.8 goes along with the funding that the city received under the Senate Bill 2 grant program earlier this year, and that calls for several things. It calls for updating your development code to have objective design standards throughout and to take a look at by right residential development and possibly in mixed use development projects as well, where there's a residential component. It also would ask the city to consider an inclusionary housing ordinance and possibly to consider looking at your density bonus ordinance and having it go above and beyond state law. So this is a program that calls for all of these things, and they will be studied in the next couple years by the city. Program 3.2 on the next slide commits the city to continue to comply with state density bonus law and to update the development code. Program 3.3 addresses resources to address homelessness, both in terms of regional partnerships and things the city can do. Program 6.1 is to take a look at the development impact fees and modify them to be based on unit size, and also to continue to monitor whether fees pose any constraint on residential development. Program 6.3 responds to another recent state law, Senate Bill 35, and calls for a process to be put in place to streamline development review for projects that are eligible under Senate Bill 35. And Program 8.2 is also in response to a recent state law, Assembly Bill 686, and this is a state law to affirmatively further fair housing. This is builds on some of the work that has been required for a long time by the federal government regarding fair housing analysis and planning. And it is tailored to each community in the state. Happy to answer questions about that if anyone is interested. We can pause here for more questions before we talk about schedule if you'd like, or I can finish that slide and then pause.
Very good. Maybe why don't you just wrap it up right now and then we'll go to questions.
Okay, so next slide, please. And then next slide. Here's a snapshot of where we are on the project. We've gotten through quite a bit, but we're really entering the public phase now. We did have our public workshop in February, but this is really the rest of the project is to receive your input and make sure that we're getting this document correct for the community. So we have done the initial drafting of the document and held the initial public workshop. The draft environmental document is being prepared, and that will be public also a little bit later. We are here today having the joint workshop with you, and we will soon submit the draft document to the state for their review. They have a 60-day review period. It doesn't always take that long, but they have the authority to take that long if they need it. And we'll have a call with them to receive their review during that time period and then work with them to address their comments. And in the meantime, I think as was mentioned near the beginning of the meeting, we'll continue to receive input. So please send in, if you're listening tonight, send in your comments and we will take a look at them. We hope that by October, that the city will have received what's called a conditional compliance letter from the state, and that happens at the end of their review. They always issue a letter, but we always shoot for what is called this conditional compliance letter, which means that we've worked with them and addressed the comments that they had, and any revisions that happen at the time of the adoption hearings will address their concerns. And then the city will be poised to receive certification once they adopt and submit to the state after adoption. So then moving through the rest of the schedule, then you have your final housing element that happens for the adoption hearings, as well as the final environmental document, adoption hearings in October and November. And then that last review by the state, we expect to have already addressed their concern, so they do have another 90 days to take a final look at the document and to certify it, and that should occur by February, hopefully. But by adopting before the end of the year, you will remain in compliance if we're staying on this schedule. So thank you for listening to all of the information tonight, and I look forward to talking more during questions.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Sinsheimer. Does Mr. Buckingham, do you conclude the remaining slides in the presentation, or where do we go, or is now a good time to break for questions?
I would break for questions.
Very good. Then let's go ahead and turn to the Planning Commission first, and we'll start with Chair Rodman, see if he has any questions.
Ron, you're muted.
You are muted, Mr. Rodman.
There we go. I got it now. I'm interested in the public input. Now, I've heard a little bit about that. We're taking a break so we can make comments. Are there phone calls being made as we've been proceeding? Are there people waiting on the line? Are we taking a plan for public input tonight?
We are, Mr. Rodman. After I go through this round of questions, I was going to turn it over to staff, make sure there was no additional information to present, and then we'll turn it over to public comments. So, yes, this is a time for questions, and then after public comment, then we'll come back for comments as well. So,
okay. I just wanted to ensure that yep. I'd like Thank to hear you. Whatever phone calls are getting. Secondly... I'm hearing a whole lot in general about what the housing needs are for RENA reasons and state requirements, and what our own requirements may be. But and I'm left with the kind of a query of housing needs and how that infects or affects our increase in density. So in opportunity sites specifically, if we could meet, and this is where the question actually comes in, if we can meet our RENA without rezoning, I would be in favor of doing that. Or if rezoning is actually almost required in order to meet our RENA, I would be very careful. I'd be very wary of rezoning just to meet RENA for reasons of density, parking, and all of those needs. I'm sorry to make that sort of unclear, but I think you get the gist of what my direction is here.
Okay, Mr. Buckingham or Ms. Sinsheimer, who wants to take a crack at that?
Sure, I'll answer that. So at this point, Commissioner Rodman, the city could not meet its RENA based on our preliminary assessment. Then there's only two ways that you can meet your RENA. You can rezone properties, or you could actually designate certain sites where if the developer provided 20% of the housing units as affordable, they could construct them by right, no public review process. While that may be something that the council wants to consider in the long term, the city doesn't have any objective design standards in place, which would be the way we would review those projects to determine that they were appropriately designed. So that's partly the reason why staff is moving forward with the proposed rezones. But remind you that the four properties that are being rezoned, one of which is owned by the city, all four of those property owners have submitted a request and are willing to rezone their properties. And candidly, none of them are very significant. We're talking about two lots owned by the Hendersons near Ramona Park that were both zoned public facilities, in a thought that many years ago that might be developed as some kind of civic center, but they're privately owned properties and they're interested in pursuing an affordable housing project. The Cleaver is the third property, and Mr. Ford's property, again, not much of a rezone. It really is just increasing the density from 9 units to 20 units. So we have four willing property owners, if you will, that would like to see their properties rezoned, and those would satisfy our RENA and provide a buffer.
Okay, I agree. I understand it more thoroughly now. Yes, thank you for that explanation. That you have relieved me of my concern. Thank you.
Very good. Let's kind of bounce back and forth. Let's go to Mayor Pro Tem Bright, see if she has any questions.
Thank you. Just a couple, actually. And it's really regarding the programs and policies. So I don't know who wants to handle these. But so the develop an ADU prototype plans, is that included in any of the programs?
I believe so. Under the ADU program, somebody want to give me a number?
Yes,
here?
It is program 6.4. yes,
6.4.
it's on page 3-11.
So, yes, in the program, Councilmember Bright, it does specifically say that the council, the city, will develop ADU prototype plans. And if you recall, part of our SB2 funding is allocated for that purpose. So we first updated our ADU ordinance, and that will be the next thing that staff will be working on, is preparing those and making those available to the public.
Thank you. I remember we discussed it, and I thought I'd been all through this, but... Anyway, Okay, great. Thank you. And then I had a question about policy 5.2. They were discussing demolition restriction. I remember a long time ago there was, I know that there had been some restrictions on demolition of a home, but I have not heard of anything like that in a long, long time. So can you just talk to me about that briefly? It's policy 5.2.
Sure. First of all, in the coastal zone, there is a specific government code, correct me if I'm wrong, Amy, but prior to demolition of a house, we have to verify what the income level is. If it is serving low income, then, and someone is living in there at the time, then the developer has to provide, as part of the new project, either another low-income unit or provide a low-income unit off-site.
Right.
So that's so, basically with this. Hold on, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're actually talking about Program 5.4, Residential Demolitions.
Well, the policy goes with the program.
Policy. So that goes with that Program 5.4.
Yes. 5.4, yes.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. And then my last one, I think. Oh, yes. Program 8.2, dedicated staff. This is affirmatively further fair housing. Is that, we currently have an intern in that position? Or do we
actually
do
we have something? We have an intern, Alistair, who did our housing conditions survey for us, which Amy touched on earlier, was a part of our requirement for this housing element update. This affirmatively further fair housing really comes out of federal law, and Amy helped me out, but basically we'll have to do I'll call it a study, but we'll have to provide this information to the state.
So it's existing federal law that was actually rolled back to some extent in the last 4 years. So the state passed a law in 2019 in response to that, is my understanding. And so it is a state law that is being implemented by this program, but it's tied to federal law. So it's a little bit confusing. And so basically every jurisdiction is required to analyze and report on fair housing to HUD under federal law periodically. I think it's every 5 years. And that's something that the city has already been doing. And so building on that, you are also required to take some steps in response to Assembly Bill 686, which is what this program is about. So where one thing to note is it says specific actions to consider in the plan include, and so you don't have to necessarily do all of the things that are listed in the bullets. You know, we worked with staff to include these bullets as things that seemed like they might be potentially things that the city would want to do, but it is really up to the city when implementing this program what's reasonable for your jurisdiction. And it's not actually a document that you have to produce. It's more that the state is looking for actions that kind of implement the fair housing documents. Does that make sense?
I see.
And I would also add, Councilmember Bright, that yes, our current code compliance officer, we respond to all code complaints, and there are on occasion, we'll say, fair housing complaints. And so if there are code violations, we deal with those. We sometimes refer those people to other services as well. So in essence, we do have already dedicated staff that's dealing with these complaints when we receive them.
He would be our dedicated staff then.
Correct.
Okay, because that was my question. I'm wondering, who are we going to have another staff member? So there we go. That was my last question. Thank you very much.
Very good. Next, we'll go to Commissioner Holden, see if she has any questions.
No questions.
Very good. Next, we'll go to Councilmember Shaw, see if she has questions.
Yeah, just a couple. One thing, this is a question about something that wasn't included as a potential site, and I just wanted to know maybe why or if it's still available. We've talked for at different times about the fact that on Grand Avenue, some of the buildings, the areas are zoned to be at least three stories and to build up. And I noticed when I was reading through the public comment and the public input, one of the comments from the public is that they wanted also to be able to build up and build high. And then when I was reading through the people's self-help recommendation, they also said incorporating more vertical high density. So I was just wondering, was it, and I know it's kind of been a dream, it's part of our Grover Beach plan or the Grand Avenue plan to have condos, kind of like a Beach Place going up high in the downtown. So I was just wondering, was that not included just because we don't really have people coming forward, or why?
So again, most of our density on Grand Avenue is 20 units per acre. And so the zoning is in place for mixed use or in the CBO zone, all residential projects, which could be a rental or for sale project. So that we already allow. Again, and also basically our height is 40 feet, which allows three stories. We do have a provision that allows for potential four stories in our downtown and at the intersection of 4th and Grand. But I really think the most appropriate time for the council to address this would be part of our SB2 grant funding and updating our development code and land use development policies is really to look at how we can facilitate more housing. And so at that time, is that would be the opportunity for the council to consider, hey, if we want to go to four stories anywhere on Grand Avenue, we could do that. Or maybe it's you only go to four stories if a certain percentage of affordable housing is allowed, which gets back to your incentives. So those are really development code standards that could be amended. And it really comes out of your SB2 program right now that says we're going to be looking at all of those factors and trying to increase housing production.
Okay, so we don't miss those opportunities by not specifically addressing them here because they already exist and we can then work on them down the road.
Correct.
Okay, and then I just want to ask about the letter from People's Self-Help Housing, because it seemed like some of the things they recommended we were already doing. And I just want to make sure, they said allow for CEQA pre-clearances on certain properties. Is that something we are doing, or does that need to be part of this, or is that a different area?
Yes and no. The reality is in Grover Beach, because we have mostly all infill projects, most of our projects comply or qualify for infill, which does not require a negative declaration or mitigated negative declaration. They are exempt if you can demonstrate that they truly are infill projects. And again, 12th and Ramona is a perfect example of that. You have a 19-unit project on a half acre exempt from CEQA. So in that respect, we're already addressing it. As part of, again, the SB2 implementation and removing barriers, that would be another opportunity, though, for the council to look at potential, even additional streamlining in our CEQA process.
Okay, so that's something, again, we can look at. The last one that I was also from that letter, that they just recommended we implement more by right permitting. So that, too, is something we would do down the road. Is that right?
Yes, that's definitely part of what the council's committed to in the SB2 grant funding is to allow projects by right. If you recall, though, part of that conversation will end up being at what threshold do you allow projects by right versus having a discretionary review process and having those objective design standards in place. So if you do have something that you're allowing by right, meaning no public hearings, staff, the council, the community has to have an adopted standard that we understand that project would have to meet in order to qualify to be constructed by right.
Okay, Thank you. That's all I had.
Very good. Next up, Commissioner Halverson.
Yeah, I don't have any specific questions. I think PlaceWorks did a great job writing this up. I'd be very fascinated to hear the state's reaction to it. Hopefully, we pass muster and we don't have to do a lot more work. And speaking of work, I think Bruce, you're taking on a few more responsibilities, you and your staff, trying to monitor this and keep reporting on it. It's going to be another chunk of work for your folks. Great. Sorry about that.
That's what we're here for.
Very good. And we'll round out questions from Councilmember Lance.
Thank you. Just two brief ones. Oh boy. I was curious, aside from the document itself, I was curious what a regional housing plan would look like. I know you talk about it from like the compact and what. I just don't really, I have no idea what that would look like. Would it just be like multi-agency and in one location? Just maybe an example.
The infrastructure plan, I guess I'm not sure if you're asking about that plan or like future regional housing planning.
Right. Like you were mentioning that, you know, we're in, encouraging, you know, our region and our partners to potentially undertake a regional plan in the future, like housing plan. Obviously, each jurisdiction is responsible for its own RENA numbers, but I'm just curious as to what a regional housing plan would look like.
Well, there are probably lots of answers to that. My understanding from working with the group is that it would be just a lot more coordination, and this is already happening, but continuing to coordinate on really where are the best places for certain types of housing in our county based on the infrastructure, based on the need, based on the jobs housing balance, you know, between, you know, where most of the jobs are, where most of the housing is, how can we get that right so people aren't driving more than they need to. And also looking at what is most appropriate in different parts of the region. So to me, it's taking it a step further than what is required by the state and actually really spending time on what is locally most needed, which is part of this required document that we do for the state, but to put even more resources towards that and to work together rather than everybody working at their own city and not touching base all the time. So hopefully there are efficiencies and solutions that come out of that. So
yeah, and I would just add too that, you know, the county has taken on a tremendous workload by leading this issue and really framing something that candidly every city has done what they wanted to do independently historically, and this is really the effort to look at this issue regionally, because it truly is. If Grover Beach produces housing, well, that's great. Even in our five cities area, we need an effort from all communities. And so this is really just the first time there's been an effort for all the cities to come together and agree that regionally we need to take this on. We can't do it one by one, and that we can only accomplish this truly a housing shortage that we have in this county and an affordability issue as well if we do this regionally.
And I'll just add to that discussion to say that I know between the county and REACH and other programs are attempting to work towards or through that the housing crisis, but then also going back to what Ms. Enshimer said at the beginning of her presentation, it does have impacts upon infrastructure and water capacity, sewer capacity, downtown opportunities for restaurants and other service centers of retail businesses and so forth. So I think taking a proactive countywide look at this and to see where housing can be in Grover Beach and what that drives towards from whether it's a beach community services or restaurants or whatnot, it kind of all it's kind of taken a full umbrella look at all of it rather than just an individual look. So looks like I've got a bad connection here for a second. I am back. Okay, Ms. Councilmember Lance, sorry about that.
Thank you. No, it's okay. My last question was really quick. At the end of the housing element document, there's a series of the programs and how some are being amended and some are being deleted and some are being rolled into another program. For the deleted ones, I'm just confirming my understanding is correct that they're being deleted because they've already been processed. Like, for example, the parking program, as far as like relooking at parking, that's being deleted because we've already done that. We've already looked at that and we've already passed an ordinance regarding that. Is my understanding correct?
Correct. We've either yes. completed a task like that, or there have been some that have been combined into one program to be a little more efficient.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. So I guess at this point, I will go ahead and open it up to public comment. And before we bring in, I know we have at least one commenter on the line. So, but before we bring her in, I would invite those who are watching to please call in at 805-321-6639 if you'd like to provide any public comment on this item this evening. So City Clerk Sims, I think you had let me know that there was at least one commenter. So if you could bring them forward.
Yes, we have Krista Jeffries.
Good evening, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Good evening. Thanks, Krista, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I know I'm limited to 3 minutes, so I'm going to try and hit all of the points that are sitting with me. I'm not representing anybody in particular. I used to sit on the board of the Five Cities Homeless Coalition, and I was the lead organizer for Slow County Yes in My Backyard. I'm not representing either of those groups today, just my own thoughts as a resident and a neighbor and a voter. First, I wanted to comment on some of the things I heard from elected officials and city staff and planning commissioners. There was some concern on would this housing on these opportunity sites be guaranteed to be affordable. And as Bruce Buckingham elaborated, there's no guarantee, but there are ways to help ensure more affordability on these sites. And as has been discussed previously, by right permits for certain levels of affordability, higher densities and more units, going higher, just putting more people, spreading that cost of building across more tenants or buyers is a good way to bring the cost down. If we can only build one, two, or even three units on a lot, you're going to be spreading the cost of building across fewer people. And I wanted to remind the group that we are here to make sure that everybody has housing, not just the people who are at the very bottom of the barrel. Lots of cities across the country, but especially in California, have been trying to say that the only housing we want to build is 100% affordable housing for the people who are the very neediest. And while they absolutely do need help, that has been a really successful way to ensure that the only people who can afford to live there are people who make well above the median income, because then you don't build any housing. And you have the opposite problem of trying to, empty out a sinking canoe with a measuring cup, and there's just more wealthy people coming to live there, and there's not enough housing being built for everyone. So we need to make sure that we're building high-income housing and build that in a dense and sustainable way, not only for climate reasons, but just to make sure that we have enough room for all of the incomes that we're going to have in Grover. I know the marijuana industry and the tech industry are growing here, and that's eventually those industries are going to command six-figure salaries and up, and those people can very easily come and buy some of the starter homes or flipper homes. But if you give them a nice penthouse with a view, they're not going to displace a renter who would previously be living in one of those smaller, older, more affordable homes. So I just wanted to remind everybody that we're here to make sure everybody has room here. Regarding whether we need to rezone in order to meet our RENA needs, I would echo Buckingham's comments that that is absolutely essential, not only to meet state law, but because we have a 40-year backlog on supply. If our current zoning was adequate to make sure that our housing stock was affordable and accessible to more people, we wouldn't be having this conversation statewide right now. So I want to encourage the staff to be proactive regarding re-envisioning the city for a more affordable and sustainable future for everybody. As to my personal suggestions that I would like to see the city focus on, I'd like to see the opportunity sites expand. In particular, all along Atlantic City Avenue, I believe should be upzoned to at least a duplex, if not R3. There was one site, 1134 Atlantic City Avenue, was available for sale for over a year. It's a 9,000 square foot lot, but it's zoned single family, and it's right by the school, it's right by the park, it's close to those new bike lanes on 13th Street, and I thought it was a real shame that it was sold without being upzoned to build more housing. The hotel housing project on Camino Real, which I know is kind of held up in limbo, even if the developer doesn't build more homes, I would like to see the zoning for those homes be increased so that over time, as more housing units are needed, maybe those single family homes can be converted to duplexes or smaller units. And then the parking lot behind Mechanics Bank on the 800 block of Grand Avenue is really, really big. And I live up the street from it. I can see it most of the time. And it's almost always empty. And the reason I know that is because my kids bike there almost all the time. And in the day and age where we're trying to reconcile our climate resiliency and our housing needs, I think parking lots make an ideal place to envision more housing. On the density bonus issue, I wanted to remind everybody that San Diego basically took the state density bonus, doubled it, and made that their city density bonus, and they didn't need to get any sort of state approval or anything like that, and that has been very successful in making sure that their housing has come down a little bit, and it's streamlined a lot. That would be something to look at. And on a much more local level, the garage mandate has always kind of been a thorn in my side for a lot of reasons. I know that we don't really need garages because we have a very mild climate, and we can see that because so many people use their garages for projects and not for storing their cars. And I would like to see the garage mandate be changed to a carport mandate because it would encourage people to use that space for their cars or get closer to living without a car so that they can use their carport for something else. I think if we're going to have abundant free street parking, a garage mandate seems kind of silly, especially when we're trying to address our climate emissions. And I'm sure that's been more than 3 minutes, but I'm going to go ahead and stop it there. If anybody has more things they want to discuss with me, please email me. I would love to talk to you. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Jeffries, for those comments. Before we turn it back over to staff to address any questions that might have come in there, let's see if there's anyone else on the line for public comment.
No, there's no one else on the line.
Very good. Thank you, City Clerk Sims. I'll go ahead and close public comment and bring it back to the council and the commission for discussion. But let's see, Mr. Buckingham, there were a couple questions in there from Ms. Jeffries that that we might be able to answer. I know the first one is the garage and carport. I believe the ADU ordinance did address some of that as well. So I'll let you respond to that if you would.
Correct. The recent action by the council on adopting the ADU ordinance did include also removing the requirement for a two-car garage associated with single-family homes. The only exception now that still requires a two-car garage as part of a planned unit development. So that mandate has been removed, and at this point, there's no requirement to even build a carport. Those can be surface parking spaces. They could be in a carport as well. And then I will also add that the density bonus is something, again, that is slated to be looked at as part of our SB2. Again, our code is not consistent now with state law, which actually increased density bonus up to 80% if you build an all affordable project. So there is a lot of work to be done in revising our density bonus as well as incentives for that. And, I would agree. There are, as I mentioned, everything on Grand Avenue that's underdeveloped really is an opportunity site by staff's measure. They may not qualify as an opportunity site, again, under HCD's criteria. And that can be just because we simply identified it previously and they won't allow us to identify it again. A perfect example of that is the Mr. Glenn property. Is currently for sale. It would be a great opportunity to provide an all housing project there with a percentage of it being affordable as well. And lastly, I would just state too that remember under the state ADU law, and what the council just recently adopted. In our R1 zones now, you can have your primary single-family residence. You can have an attached junior ADU, which can be up to 500 square feet, and a detached ADU up to 1,200 square feet. So in essence, our R1 zones do allow up to 3 units on one lot. That's all I have, unless there are any other specific questions I missed that you'd like to have a response to.
No, very good. I think that was all that I had captured, so I appreciate that update. So let's go ahead and bring it back to, again, the Council and the Commission for direction. So I guess this evening, Mr. Buckingham and Ms. Hinsheimer, where do we need to get you this evening? So which is probably a perfect introduction to this next slide.
So we just happen to have a slide for you, Mayor. There are 4 basic questions here. If you can just go through them, so far, we didn't hear any specific comments about are the programs acceptable. So if you can proceed with giving us some direction, that would be great.
Very good. So I think what I'll do tonight, as I've done in other meetings, and it seems to work well, is let's start with the goals, the policies, and the programs from a straw poll standpoint. I can't see everybody's face, but if you have concerns about any of those, please either press the raise your hand button or kind of wave. And I'll turn to Mayor Pro Tem Bright, because I think you said you don't have the wave button. So I'll ask you, see if there's anything, concerns in the goals, the policies, and programs.
I have no concerns.
Okay. Very good. And
can I... This is Council. Can I speak on? I just wanted to. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Mr. Rodman.
Okay, I just wanted to jump in here before I had a comment I wanted to make about the public's comment that I appreciate her encouragement for us to have some sort of a balance between affordability and increasing high-income housing. And I just appreciate that comment, and I think she was very good in stating how we continue to not forget that we want to maintain and increase high-income housing as much as the state will allow. Thank you for that opportunity, and then we can progress with these council directions.
Very good. Well said. Yes, there is an opportunity for all incomes to participate in housing in Grover Beach, and I think as we bring in affordable housing, that does allow for those residents to hopefully to expand upwards into the next levels of housing. So thank you for that reminder, Mr. Rodman. Let's see, I don't see any hands raised, so unless there's someone who wants to speak, I'll consider the goals, policies, and programs acceptable to the group. Next, we'll go into if there's any additional goals, policies, and programs that anyone would like to see as part of the housing element. I think we've had quite a bit of discussion about the SB2 programs coming forward, so that may be where we might consider some of the changes that people may want to make to the housing element in putting that into the SB2 program. And so with that, perhaps Mr. Buckingham, does the Planning Commission have an opportunity to provide input separately on the SB2 item factors or the programs, or is that coming solely to the council?
At this point, the way staff envisions it, once the housing element is adopted and we have our programs, we will immediately move forward with implementing program for SB2. And that will start with staff bringing on a consultant who is an expert in housing. It will probably be a couple of initial public workshops to get input from both the commission and council, and then direction from the council on how to move forward. So there will be a lot of public input from both the commission and the council, as there would be the potential for some real significant changes to our development code and land use element as part of that process.
Okay, very good. So it sounds like it will come to the Planning Commission for review and comment at that time as well. So very good. So not seeing anybody moving forward with additional goals, policies, and programs. I'll consider that we are good on that item. So next we'll go into the rezone sites if they are acceptable to the group. So anybody have any concerns on the rezone sites that they want to express or any comments that they want to make?
Yes.
Mr. Rodman, certainly.
I just want to thank the staff for their work on this, and I understand that the need for rezoning and how it could meet the arena. So, yes, I have no further concerns on that.
Very good. Is there anyone else that wants to make a comment on the rezone sites? Seeing no one come forward, we'll say the rezone sites are acceptable as well. And I do want to say again, thank you, as Mr. Rodman did, as all of us want to show our appreciation to staff as well as Playworks this evening, as for all of the work and the effort that has gone into this. I think getting us to this point has been a Herculean effort, and it's great that we're ahead of schedule even in this time of COVID. So let's go to the last council direction or council commission direction to see if there's any revisions to other portions of the draft housing elements that we'd like to include. It kind of builds upon the additional goals, policies, and programs, but let's see if there's anything else that anyone wants to include into the draft housing element. Okay, not hearing anyone come forward specifically. I will say we've done some great work tonight. Looks like you've got a consensus on each of the items you've asked for this evening. Let's see if there's anything else from staff's perspective that you would like us to discuss on this item specifically.
We lost you.
Oh, you muted yourself, Mr. Buckingham.
All right. How about that time? Just wanted to pass along one additional comment in response to a comment Chair Rodman made. There is other public outreach that's going on behind the scenes that's not so apparent. We have met regionally with stakeholders. And we also had a presentation that Associate Planner Reese and I gave to the Home Builders Association and the EVC, the Economic Vitality Corporation, who are key players in the development community. So there is outreach going out beyond just the community.
Good.
That's all I had to add.
Good.
Very good. So I think that does wrap up our working on our opportunity to bring both the council and the commission together tonight. And I do want to say thank you to everyone for joining us, but I did want to give folks an opportunity just to say anything else that might be interactive between the council and the commission that would be helpful for you this evening. And we might be able to move forward. Obviously, it's not on the agenda this evening, but we could possibly turn it back over to staff direction for that. So let me start with Chair Rodman and see if there's anything he wants to share.
I appreciate this opportunity to meet with the council to hear your folks' comments. And I just appreciate this opportunity. I encourage any further opportunity for us to meet with the council in a format like this or more of an informal format. So, good work. Keep it up.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner Halverson. See if there's anything you wanted to add.
Yeah, I guess I would echo what Commissioner Rodman just said. We're making some major changes to the way neighborhood is defined in our cities with all this, and I think it's great that we are all getting together to talk about it carefully and review the recommendations and not do anything too hasty, even though the state is sort of pushing us from behind as fast as they can. So I appreciate the fact that we're getting together and talking, and Like I say, I think it's going to take a lot of thought and some restraint so that we don't go too far too fast. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you for that. Commissioner Holden, anything you wanted to share?
I just appreciate being here as well and getting all this was a lot of work, so thanks to everybody.
Very good. Thank you for joining us tonight, and thank you all for the planning commissioners for all the service that you do for the city as well. We appreciate it and look forward to you doing some heavy lifting on some future projects as well. So let's see if Councilmember Shaw has any comments.
I just am looking forward now to the next steps and how we get to flesh this out. I know this is just a guiding document, but it was a ton of work, so I appreciate everyone's effort. And it was really fun to work with the planning commissioners because, I mean, I know I personally appreciate the way they make their decisions. They're always well-reasoned. And when we have to build on them, I never am really in doubt because they always are very well-reasoned decisions. So I just appreciate the opportunity for us to work together and look forward to more in the future.
Very good. Councilmember Lance.
Thank you. Also, great that we could all get together in this format. I always hear about the Planning Commission and the decisions they've made, but I've, you know, not had the chance to actually collaborate with you all. So this was a joy. I think our work will be cut out for us, the Council and the Planning Commission, when we start talking about the SB2 changes that we want to make in the development ordinances. So I know this is a lot of work, but I think we have a lot more work ahead of us when we actually look to make those fundamental changes that I think our community will have probably more input on because it will be on a more granular level that everybody will be affected by positively or negatively or otherwise. So look forward to seeing how that collaboration looks and what decisions are made through that process. But thanks for having me in this format.
Very good. Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Thank you. Yes, well, I really can't add much more, but as a previous planning commissioner, three terms, I really do thank you for your time tonight and for all the work that you do and all the time that you spend doing it. So thank you again, and I look forward to many more opportunities to work with you. So thanks again. And it was nice seeing all your faces.
Yep. And I'll just close by saying once again, thank you as well. And while it's been me like this, I hopefully the next time we get a chance to get together, it is in person in a newly revamped and renovated City Hall chambers. So, with that, I'll go ahead and turn it back over to Mr. Buckingham or Mr. Bronson and see if there's any closing or parting comments that need to be made this evening.
Yeah, I'll just thank the commission and council. As you see, this is a very detailed document. There is a lot of demographic information. It is a requirement of the state, but it helps us put it in context of which direction and what kind of policy and programs we need to look at. So again, I just appreciate it's a very technical data and like the fact that we've actually made a lot of strides in housing via council policies over the last 10 years. And I'll reiterate, I mean, I think we really have removed a lot of barriers to housing, but this process and as a few alluded to, the SB2 process and updating our development codes will be the next step in really transforming and being able to facilitate housing to the maximum extent in Grover Beach. So thank you.
And I'll just add on behalf of of our staff team. Thank you to the council and to the commissioners for your great discussion this evening, great questions. This is really how public policy is shaped and made as we go forward. And also I want to thank Bruce Buckingham and his staff team. Our community development department has done a marvelous job in helping advance this forward. Thank you to PlaceWorks, Amy, and your team. This is really a total collective effort and how we provide housing for all across our community. So thank you to our staff team, our consultants, and to our commissioners and council members for your diligence this evening.
Very good. Thank you, everyone. So yes, Amy, thank you for your participation this evening. We look forward to the final draft. We look forward to the state saying yes to our housing element and giving developers and the residents and community members the opportunity to have affordable housing and all sectors of housing throughout the community. So, with that, unless I see a hand otherwise, I will consider us adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Good night.
Good night. Thanks.